I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. By just about any measure, President Obama had a tough week last week, dealing with charges of a White House cover-up over the attack in Benghazi, Libya, revelations that the IRS was giving conservative groups seeking tax-exempt status extra scrutiny, admission that the Justice Department had secretly seized AP phone records, and another disturbing report about the problem of sexual assault in the military. While some Republicans were using the words impeachment and Watergate last week, others were walking back some of the rhetoric on yesterday's TV talk shows. Well, here to talk about what all this means is James Peterson and Robert Costa. James Peterson, Director of Africana Studies, Associate Professor of English at Lehigh University, a contributor to MSNBC. James Peterson, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning. And on the telephone is Robert Costa, Washington editor for the National Review, a political analyst for CNBC. His blog, The Corner, is found at nationalreview.com. And Robert Costa, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
No, it's great to join you, Marty.
Robert, let me begin with you. Looking at President Obama's week last week, do you think it was just a bad week for the president or something more about his second term?
I think a tide has turned for this administration. The president for almost 5 years has been quite effective at being popular, not only with the American people, but with the press. And I think with these scandals, we're seeing the press for the first time really be antagonistic towards the president, especially I think because they're irked about the AP scandal. They hear about James Rosen from Fox News being followed by the Department of Justice. And so this has gotten the press interested, and I think all these problems are not the end of the presidency. It's just a bump in the road perhaps for the president, but the problem for the White House is that I think these problems could fester, and this could be the summer of scandal here in the Beltway.
James Peterson, a summer of scandal. Do you see that?
Not so much. I mean, I think I don't think all three of them have, or all four of these have, as much staying power. I actually believe that the challenges around sexual assault in the military has the most staying power and actually has the most substance of all these issues. It is, when you look at the data and the numbers on that, and you look at the challenges around trying to sort of overcome chain of command in terms of how we litigate those processes, Chuck Hagel and the president and everyone involved in that process has a lot of work to do. That, I think, could persist through the summer. Some of these other pieces, it'll be interesting to see how they resolve themselves. I feel like Republicans will want to keep Benghazi in particular in the ether, in the atmosphere over the course of the summer. And there will be certain of the president's opponents that will also want to make sure that the IRS targeting scandal stays there as well. But I'm not sure if they have the same kind of substantive staying power as the actual sexual assault in the military piece does.
And Robert, I wonder if for Republicans there are risks by talking about last week the word impeachment came up, the word Watergate came up, even the word scandal. Are there risks by using some of that language?
I don't think so. I mean, you're right. For most of the president's first term, and for the beginning of the second, using language like impeachment was considered hyperbolic, and Republicans were wary of that. And I, here on Capitol Hill, my job is to cover Congress, cover campaigns, and I know that the leadership in the Senate and the House for Republicans was privately advising the members not to start using these kind of loaded terms. But when you have someone like Bob Woodward of Watergate fame go on Meet the Press and other programs and say that the Obama administration is acted in a Nixonian way, I think Republicans have a little more cover than usual.
I don't know
if they have enough cover to have the term impeachment floated out there yet. Certainly the term scandal. I mean, comparisons to Nixon, I would you know, even to all due respect to Mr. Woodward, refer back to history and take a really close look at these things. I mean, what happens is that this is a political opportunity. These are political opportunities. We should not be surprised that politicians will leverage and exploit political opportunities in all of these. It doesn't mean that the administration is not in error or it doesn't need to have more oversight in certain areas. It certainly doesn't mean that these are all trumped up on the other end of that spectrum. What it means is that it's a political opportunity. People will play politics with it.
But do you think there's room for nuance?
There should be.
You can say no if you want to.
Well, listen, there should, again, we should separate them. I would say that the sexual assault in the military is just, to me, totally different from these other three. When it comes to Benghazi, it's awful, the four Americans that we lost in that. But I think there's bigger things for us to think about with each of these. So in terms of Benghazi, I want us to think about what's the CIA's role in terms of the kinds of interventions that we make overseas in terms of prosecuting the war on terror. To me, that's the real question around that scenario. When you talk about the IRS and targeting, you know, not even going as far as saying reforming the tax code, but we really should look hard at 501c4s and really figure out if we should even be charging the IRS with making these kinds of assessments. I would say no. And then when we look at the AP piece, you know, obviously we need to get a robust media shield law in place, actually one that I think may be more robust than the Obama administration wants to do right now. And we need to have the conversation about the balance between national security and reporting the news. In this day and age, that's, I think, a worthwhile, healthy conversation for us to have. So there are real things for us to talk about around these issues. The question as to whether or not we'll do that remains to be seen.
Robert Kossel, let me pick up on the Benghazi, because each of these deserves actually an hour, which we don't have. But nonetheless, when you look at the Benghazi attacks on September 11th last year, the Obama administration released something like 100 pages of emails showing that in many ways the CIA was the organization that was really fine-tuning some of this language used by Susan Rice on that fateful Sunday after those attacks. Is there any there from your perspective?
I just sat down on Friday with Jason Chaffetz. He's a Republican congressman from Utah, and he's head of the Subcommittee on National Security on the House Oversight Committee. And he was the congressman, along with Daryl Issa, who brought Gregory Hicks, the former deputy chief of mission in Libya, to the House. And I think it was Gregory Hicks's testimony before the House that really broke open the Benghazi investigation, because it seemed like the administration may not have done enough. And now the president, of course, and his allies went on the Sunday shows this weekend and talked about how the administration was fully engaged and acted responsibly after the attacks. But the questions Republicans have remain, and this is why I think it's going to fester just from a political perspective. Yes, the White House released 100 emails, but there are thousands of documents at the State Department and within the White House about the conduct of the White House and the administration on the night of September 11th and soon after. And you're going to hear Republicans day after day keep asking for more documents. And I think until there are more documents beyond these 100 emails, this is going to continue to be a thorn in the side for the administration.
But are you saying, Robert, that this is that the White House engaged in some kind of a cover-up? And if they did, what were they covering up?
I'm not making that claim at all, but Republicans are definitely making that claim here in Washington. Their claim is that when the attack happened, the president was almost out of pocket, wasn't acting in a responsible fashion, and they think Hillary Clinton may have stopped the administration from having some kind of military force come in the night of. And that's what Republicans are looking for. It could be a wild goose chase, but they're going to continue to hit this question because they keep thinking the administration did not do enough to protect the mission in Tripoli and the consulate office in Benghazi.
Go ahead, James.
Well, for Republicans, the perception of what Robert is talking about is just as important as to whether or not the facts are there. So they will try to get to the bottom of whatever the there is they're looking for, to the extent that they can keep Hillary Clinton in that mix. In terms of the accountability for whatever they're saying is wrong, they're going
to
continue
to do it. She was Secretary of State.
Absolutely, absolutely. But again, the perception of it for the president's political opponents, that they're weak on terror or weren't assertive enough in this particular case or weren't smart enough about this anniversary of 9/11, the perception of that for them is just as valuable as whether or not the facts. So, again, we may see these things floating around. I think the real conversation to have is the relationship between the CIA and the role that the CIA has in terms of the kinds of interventions we're making when we prosecute the war on terror. This, to me, is also connected to the AP scandal in the sense that...
But there are minor questions to ask, right? I mean, the administration, in the immediate aftermath of the Benghazi attacks, talked about a video being the main cause, and the talking points talked about a video on YouTube being the cause for the attacks. And then now, of course, the administration says that it was not the video that led to the terrorist attack. So there was obviously some kind of miscommunication with the public, and that's why I think Republicans think they have a sore spot for the administration to go in there and press the issue, because they think there was some kind of fumble in the immediate aftermath.
Maybe there was a fumble there, Robert. You're right. But there were demonstrations and different things going on in the region based upon that video. So to take that, to go from that step to the administration deliberately trying to cover something up, to me, doesn't make that much sense. And again, it abnegates our responsibility for actually having the conversation about how do we protect our sort of diplomats in these different regions, and to what extent are we going to continue to prosecute the war on terror in this same mode? Are we even going to think about reordering how we do this so that we're not even in these situations going forward?
But Robert Casa, do you think it's important that the president and other members of his administration at times talked about an act of terrorism, a terrorism attack, a terrorist terrorism? I mean, it seems that a lot of the criticism stems on the use of the word terror, whether it's a noun or verb or an adjective.
I think that was more of a question, Marty, during the campaign. Right after the attack in September and October, the administration seemed initially hesitant to use the word terrorism. But now all administration officials and all Republican leaders seem to agree that this was a coordinated terrorist attack with a brute force, a lot of arms on the ground in Benghazi. And I think there's no, the semantics of the Benghazi attack, I think, is almost an old story. There's no question now that this was a terrorist attack. The question is the conduct of the administration. Did Hillary Clinton respond in an appropriate fashion? Should military force have been sent in that evening, within 12 hours, within 24 hours? What was the protocol? Did the White House obstruct, for instance, the investigation in Congress when congressional investigators went over in October of 2012? Did the State Department do anything to help them, or were they trying to obstruct them? And Chaffetz, for example, told me on Friday that he felt like he was obstructed. Now, of course, Democrats and the administration have pushed back against this notion, but my whole point is, as a reporter, this tension is really there between the Republicans and the White House.
Well, I think that's clear, but also we heard from members of the military that there was no way that special forces or our airplanes could have gotten to Benghazi in a timely way.
Right, and one quick point on that. Republicans have heard this in the public and in the press, and so why Benghazi is going to continue to be an issue is you're going to see perhaps some subpoenas come out to military officials to hear more about how they were approached by the White House and dealt with the State Department that night. And so the military angle of this is something I hear Republicans are going to go after.
Go ahead, Jay.
Yeah, again, I just think we're leaving the CIA out a little bit too much in this. I think part of the reason why you can talk about it as an act of terror right now is because the CIA said you can talk about it as an act of terror. And I'm just curious as to how much of this is Monday morning quarterbacking. You know, how much of this ultimately will be about the fact that it's easy for us to look back and say, hey, we should have done this at this time, we should have done this at that time, but to have that forethought in the heat of that moment with what was going on in the region already. And again, I'm not trying to defend this at all, because I honestly am against the war on terror. I think we need to be much more diplomatic and sort of prosecute this war, if you will, in a very, very different way. But how do you have that? It seems like Monday morning quarterbacking. Like we can look back and say we should have done this and done that at this particular time, but I'm not sure if you could have done that in the heat of that particular moment if we understand all the factors that were at play in that moment.
Well, we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's James Peterson, Director of Africana Studies, Associate Professor of English at Lehigh University, a contributor to MSNBC. Robert Casa joining us by telephone. He's Washington editor for National Review, a political analyst for CNBC. His blog, The Corner, is found at nationalreview.com. And we are talking about the issues consuming Congress and the White House. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Give us a call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY. Do your drinking habits cause problems in your personal or professional life? Do you drink to cope with stress? These may be signs of alcohol dependence. UPenn is conducting a research study using naltrexone, an FDA-approved medication for use in treating alcoholism. If you are 18 or older, have an alcohol problem, and want to reduce your drinking, you may qualify for the study. Details at drinkinginphilly.com.
You decide the winners at WHYY's second annual Best of the Chefs, June 20th at WHYY in Philadelphia. Food fanatics will love this two-hour tasting, featuring an array of mouth-watering munchies served up by local restaurants and businesses, all competing to be named 2013's Best of the Chefs, with summer beer garden, specialty cocktails, and live music. WHYY's second annual Best of the Chefs. Tickets at whyy.org/events.
When Peter Hook first met Joy Division bandmate Ian Curtis, he didn't notice the word hate written on his jacket.
Amazingly, I saw the front of him before I saw the back of him. And if somebody had said to me, "What do you think that young man's got written on his back?" I would have thought it was a picture of kittens.
Peter Hook remembers Ian Curtis and Joy Division this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Robert Costa and James Peterson about some of the issues, rightly or wrongly, that are consuming Congress and the White House these days. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. James, let me toss this to you about the IRS's special or extra scrutiny of some of these nonprofits tied to conservative organizations. The words Tea Party, the words Patriot were sort of flashpoints for some of these investigators. What do you make of this story?
Well, I think it's a terrible thing if the IRS targets groups for political reasons. It was extremely disturbing to me when the NAACP was targeted under the Bush administration. And when this news broke, I felt equally disturbed about the government sort of at least even appearing to target entities based upon politics. We can't live in a country that's like that. Now, that being said, I really feel like the real story here is about 501c4s and whether or not they should even be eligible for tax-exempt status, whether or not we should charge the IRS with making these sort of parsing these distinctions between social welfare versus political action. And obviously the IRS has not been very capable of doing that either on the left or the right. We have these huge sort of 501c4s on both sides of the political equation that act politically and essentially are being subsidized by the American taxpayers because of this particular status. So yes, we need to figure out who did what and where and when. And obviously the news broke this morning that the White House counsel was aware of this at least 3 weeks ago. That's important information. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, I think that the 501c4 status is what the real issue, the real scandal is.
What do you think the real scandal is, Robert?
I think the real scandal is the scandal. There's not a subtext scandal here. The scandal is that the IRS targeted conservative groups, and this went on for a long time, 2010 to 2012, and the administration didn't seem to inform the public before the election. It just recently came to light because of an inspector general report at the Treasury Department, and the administration continues to say they did nothing wrong. They were just letting the IG do his work, but the question is, and this is the looming question, who in the administration, if anyone, was it a third-rate bureaucrat? Or was it a White House official? Did they ask the IRS or someone within the IRS to target Tea Party and conservative groups? And if they did, this is a major mm-hmm. scandal because that's a misuse of the IRS, which is supposed to be just a revenue body and an objective and nonpartisan.
I don't know, Robert, if you read over the weekend, the New York Times had a long story about this office in Cincinnati. And it shows, obviously, the complexity of this story, but it also shows an office that was overwhelmed. They had unclear, I guess, direction about how they were supposed to go through these thousands and thousands of people that were applying for tax-exempt status. You had low-level workers trying to manage all this bureaucracy. I think there's something like 4 million words in the IRS tax code. Do you have any sympathy for those workers in Cincinnati?
No, I think there was a good reporting in the New York Times, but I think the theme of the article was a bit off because, look, it's easy to pass this entire story off and saying this was just bureaucrats in some office in Cincinnati dealing with a lot of paper, and in the midst of dealing with a lot of paper, they decided to make that process move quickly. They would suddenly decide to target Tea Party groups because this would make the paper pile go down fast. And that was the theme of the New York Times piece. It was well reported about how they're really hamstrung out in Cincinnati. But the question remains, who directed that to happen? I don't buy the argument as a reporter or just as a citizen that this whole operation to target 501c4 applications that were held up for years was just part of a process to get rid of the bureaucracy within an office of the IRS. Someone within the administration, maybe the White House never knew. I'm not making that claim at all. But someone within the administration or within the IRS decided to do this, and that's the story here, not that some bureaucrat struggled to deal with too much work.
What do you think, James?
Well, the head of the IRS at the time, a Bush appointee, is no longer there. The acting one is gone. So I'm not sure how many more heads we need to see roll. Maybe we need to see the actual people who oversaw the tax-exempt status units, whoever maybe the D.C. officials were that were aware of this. But there's no connection whatsoever to the White House at this particular point.
And
nothing has been reported.
Deputy Secretary of the Treasury, Neil Wolin, knew last year, and I spoke to a Treasury official over the weekend. They said that Deputy Wolin was well aware. He's an Obama appointee, deputy head of the Treasury, was well aware of the investigation, and the White House knew last year as well, the White House counsel. The question is, did the White House counsel inform the president?
Well, the president is not supposed to be informed about
exactly
things like this. Isn't that true, Robert?
That is true, but no one knows really who knew what. So two things I'd advise listeners this week. You got the Senate Finance Committee on Tuesday,
right,
and the House Oversight Committee on Wednesday are going to be pressing the IRS officials. Doug Shulman, the Bush appointee who is running the IRS at the time, will be coming to the Hill. These will be heated hearings. This is where we'll find some new information.
You're saying, James Peterson, we need to look at these 501c4s.
Yeah, I mean, again, I want to be very, very clear that I think Robert is right, that we need to resolve this issue and make sure that we hold accountable everyone who was involved in the IRS, even if it is for a shortcut purpose. It's still discriminatory, and still we can't tolerate. We have to have zero tolerance for that. But for me, the real issue is, should 501c4s, even these kinds of 501c4s, should they even have tax-exempt status? Should they be eligible for tax-exempt status? And I think no.
Because they are, at least on paper, they're supposed to be doing social welfare.
Yes, they're supposed to be community kinds of organizations, and they're making they have a tremendous impact on our political process. They spend a tremendous amount of money, create a tremendous amount of political ads, and they interrupt and intervene in our political process. So they are political entities that have tax-exempt status. And
that's not always true. Not all 501c4s are political. I mean, they're not supposed to be political.
Not all of them, but I'm talking about...
For instance, a group that does educational work on the Constitution, a group that does educational work on history.
Fine. Let those groups exist and stand, Robert. You know exactly which groups I'm talking about.
Well, why don't you name... Well, go ahead.
Well, I mean, there's not all Tea Party groups. I mean, what's the name of the PAC that that Bill Maher gave $1 million to for President Obama last year? 501c4 status, right? So if they're clearly community social welfare organizations, fine. Yeah. But if they're political organizations, we need to identify them as such. And I don't think that it's within the purview of the IRS to have to field thousands of these applications and make those distinctions.
But I wonder whether, and just picking up on that, Robert, then we'll get to some callers here, looking at the fact that these 501c4s, unlimited funds, yeah, and no access to donors, it doesn't matter, it seems to me, which side of the political fence you're on, that would be important information, especially for people seeking tax-exempt status.
I disagree, because political speech should be protected, and if it's not for a political purpose, legally, people should have their speech protected. They should have the right to perhaps privacy. At least the Supreme Court has ruled in that way, and with the Citizens United case, that these kind of groups are able to do activities related to public policy, related to education and social welfare. But as long as you're not explicitly involved in a campaign, according to the law, you don't have to reveal. And I think maybe campaign disclosure is always a positive thing, but these aren't campaigns.
Do you agree with that, James?
No, because some of these organizations have tremendous impact on campaigns. So, again, we can play semantics with it. I'm just giving you my opinion. My opinion is that it should not be within the purview of the IRS to make these kinds of what are really, I think, nuanced distinctions between a political action organization and a social welfare organization. If we can come to some agreement about how you make those distinctions and create a rubric for the IRS, maybe that's a good idea. But as of now, some of these organizations that have 501c4 status have had tremendous impact on our last couple of elections. So,
you know the reason why people want 501c4s is because they encourage a public dialogue, and a lot of people who don't want to give to campaigns and don't want to be taxed for campaigns still want to be part of the larger American conversation. And the thought process is that these groups enable that kind of speech. Mm. Now, that there could be problems there. I'm not saying these groups are perfect at all, but that's the whole thought process behind having these types of groups.
But just quickly there, Robert, I mean, do you see an ad as a dialogue starter?
Sure. I mean, if a public policy group puts forward an ad on education or puts forward an ad on energy, you're allowed to make an argument in the public discourse without having to be an endorsement of a candidate or a political party. And I think ads on the web, ads on television, these are part of the process. Why can't a group advertise if it has a certain point of view?
That's
I'm just talking about tax exempt status. Of course, a group can.
Right. If you're not, at least according to the law, all these groups are with it. I think it's fine to have a larger conversation about 501c4s. Mm-hmm. But the real question here is the IRS. And if the IRS, can the IRS even have the purview to manage these applications? And
clearly they can, Robert. Clearly they cannot.
I think it's funny that we're having a conversation about 501c4s being too political when it was really the IRS that was overly political in managing the applications.
Well, that again hasn't necessarily been proven as of yet. We're assuming that because it looks that way. It could ultimately come down to the fact that they just use it as a shortcut because they were inundated with many, many more of these kinds of applications than they were for those representing left or progressive 501c4 application processes. But I think it's absolutely fair to call into question the very, very tax-exempt status around which this particular issue hinges. And again, we're going to, I think, Robert, you and I will probably agree to disagree here. I don't think that the IRS, and I don't want to talk about capabilities, I just don't think that it's within their purview from a political government sort of perspective.
It's a classic liberal-conservative argument. The conservative argument is free speech, political speech, speech about public policy should not be taxed, and the more liberal argument is that if you're making any kind of speech, political, semi-political, vaguely political, it should be taxed.
I don't think you exactly agree even on that definition, but let me just quickly reintroduce you. Robert Costa joining us by telephone from National Review, where he is their Washington editor. James Peterson here with us in our Philadelphia studios, director of Africana Studies at Lehigh University. And we are talking about a whole host of things, including 501c4 tax exemption. We've been talking about Benghazi and some of the issues that have been consuming Washington in the last week or so. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Patricia from Valley Forge to join us. And Patricia, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you for the call.
Sure.
And the 501, what, CO4,
yes.
They were swamped because for the very reason that they don't have to reveal their donors. And you can't deny that Karl Rove and that group have raised millions of dollars for their candidates, their Republican candidates. The thing is, the Supreme Court made it absolutely possible that our candidates will be chosen by money, and they have for a long time. But this is the worst thing that ever came down from the Supreme Court.
Well, Patricia, I appreciate your call to Radio Times. And Robert Costa, one of the critiques of this is that the IRS was going after the little guys and leaving, you know, American Crossroads and some of these larger organizations alone. Is there some truth to that?
There may be some truth to that. But I think the caller brings up a great point. That a lot of the suspicion on the right is that the administration was very unhappy with the Citizens United ruling.
Right.
And because they were unhappy with the Citizens United ruling, they used the IRS to almost get around Citizens United, which made it much more easy and open for 501c4 groups to get through to the IRS and get tax exempt status. And so I think that's a question I'd like to find an answer to. What did IRS officials talk to their employees about mm-hmm. regarding Citizens United? Was there an antagonism within the IRS towards Citizens United? Maybe that informs some of these decisions.
Well, James, I remember one of the State of the Union addresses, President Obama, and there were members of the Supreme Court sitting right there,
yeah.
And he criticized Citizens United.
He did, which is somewhat unprecedented. And I think Robert is right here, especially because you know, narratives are what generate our perception of scandals. And that narrative that Robert just gave probably will make a lot of sense to a lot of folk, because people are genuinely outraged by Citizens United. And it, clearly the president was also outraged by it, because he knew precisely how it would impact the upcoming presidential election. And so then when you start to put the narrative together that way, that's how conspiracies work, right? But I, again, we need a lot more information and evidence to underwrite that. Just because we're frustrated about Citizens United at the grassroots level or at the sort of high-end political level does not mean that the president or the White House would engage in this kind of discriminatory practices.
And Marty, can I give a real 10-second credit to the president?
I think
politically, you got to appreciate the president came out very quickly and said this was outrageous.
Yep.
A head was rolled. Stephen Miller was asked to resign by Jack Lew and the president, acting director of the IRS. Yep. Schuman, I'm sure, would have been asked to resign if he was still there. And so the president, I think, really showed crisis management skills here. He recognized this is a problem for the administration. We can have an argument whether it should be this big of a problem for the administration, but politically the president has acted on this. And I think he deserves credit for recognizing that this really irritates a lot of people. And it makes a lot of people fearful about the IRS and the administration in general, and I think he's tried to be on top of that.
Well, let me pick up on this and go back to you, James, which is people on the left and Democrats have criticized President Obama for either not using his bully pulpit in an effective kind of way.
Right.
And that's part of my question. The other one is whether we are learning real limits to executive power, whether the public, maybe even the press, thinks that the president has more power than he actually has in real life.
Well, I mean, how you feel about this depends upon how you feel about this particular president. So obviously those who are to the left of this president feel like the real scandals are that black unemployment is twice what regular unemployment is, feel like the real scandals have to do with Race to the Top not being very much different for them than No Child Left Behind. Like, there are people who feel like there are real scandals in terms of what a progressive president should be doing and what is not happening. And then there are those, most of them on the right, who feel like too much overreach. This president has been really assertive and fairly dogmatic about certain policies, about a very, very progressive liberal agenda. Now, mind you, this is the strange thing for someone like me.
And
those on the right,
where do you fit?
Well, I guess I'm center left, right? But there are plenty of people to the left of me that feel like this president is way too far to the right. Plenty of folk on the right feel like this president is just way too far to the left. It's the kind of the political miasma of our current state of sort of politics here in this country. But what I would also agree with Robert that the crisis management piece was really, really interesting last week, because he releases the emails that, according to Robert, is still not enough documentation. He fires the IRS person. And then also he gets Chuck Schumer to initiate the media, to reintroduce the media shield law. And so that was a very, very effective way of addressing, I think a lot of issues. But ultimately, political common sense tells me that if he's alienating folk on the right and folk on the left, then maybe he's doing something right.
What do you think about that, Robert?
I think the president has acted strongly to try to get on top of the issue, but I think the administration still hopes this thing just kind of fizzles, and I just don't see that happening. I know House Republicans, I'm close to House Republicans as a reporter, I cover them, they are only just starting to gear up, and these things are not just beginning. This summer
for all three of these things, or do you see?
I think most of the IRS, but Benghazi remains a hot topic on the right. And I think one person who's going to be under fire is Eric Holder, the Attorney General.
Yeah.
He's very close to the president. Republicans target him as someone who's a true confidant of the president. And with DOJ now getting heat today for going after James Rosen, a Fox News reporter, going after the AP, there's going to be maybe calls for a special counsel to look into some of these issues, a select committee on Benghazi in the House. These are all things that are floated in the air. And so I think the president will be tested this summer. It's going to be a real
test.
We're
going to waste so much time in committees. So much time.
Well, we need to take a very short break in Radio Times, in this hour of Radio Times, talking with Robert Costa and James Peterson about a whole host of issues that have been consuming Washington. We want to hear from you. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. After the break, jobs, the economy, immigration, and more. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Theater Horizon supports WHYY and presents Spring Awakening, a rock musical about adolescents colliding with each other and with a world that cannot contain their desires. Set in repressive 19th century Germany, Spring Awakening ignites conversations between parents and teens about coming of age and gives parents a safe vehicle for talking more openly with their children. Spring Awakening, now through June 9th. Recommended for mature audiences only. Details online at theaterhorizon.org or 610-283-2230.
So how does Mel Brooks feel about being on Fresh Air?
Public radio. I mean, this is my career. I'm finished. It's over. I'm picking up cigarette butts.
Mel Brooks on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Mental illness affects the entire family. How to explain to children when their father can't get up to go to work or mom cries all the time? I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll discuss how families can cope, how parents can parent, and what resources are available for families affected by mental illness. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. The Obama administration has had to deal with a cascade of damning reports and allegations of scandal and cover-up, charges that the government is either corrupt or power-hungry or inept. Talking with James Peterson, Director of Africana Studies at Lehigh University, and Robert Costa, Washington Editor for National Review, and speaking with you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Robert Costa, if Congress is going to be consumed with the IRS allegations and Benghazi and some of these other issues we have been talking about, what happens to things like jobs and the economy and trying to get the, you know, get the country back to work, so to speak?
I think those should always be the central issues, but I think they will be on the back burner for the time being. I think the struggle right now is that Republicans lost the election, and this is a party in disarray. There's no national real leader for the party right now. For the first few months, you had Boehner had a coup attempt in the House. They struggled on certain issues. The sequester was messy. The fiscal cliff was messy. And so now the party is trying to find some kind of strategy for cohesion. And the IRS scandal especially has galvanized the right. And John Boehner, who has long had difficult relations with the right flank in Congress, finds himself a team player, someone who the conservatives are working with hand in hand. And in the Senate, you have Mitch McConnell, who has had his own struggles with the right flank of the Senate, also working very hard on IRS and Benghazi to press the administration. And so the leadership, I think, is going to continue to hit these issues, which makes this different than a lot of other things earlier this year and last year. If the leadership is working with the conservatives in the House and the Senate, that means this is going to continue to be a problem
but
for the administration.
For the administration. But what do you think, and you know, I don't like to rely on polls, but looking at some polls over the last week or so, it looks like this isn't sticking to the president, if I can say
that.
Well,
that's what I call the big fear of 1998. You had the famous Clinton scandals, and the Republicans went very hard under Newt Gingrich's leadership against the administration, impeachment proceedings. And then, of course, in the 1998 midterms, what happened? After a whole year of scandal, Republicans had a disappointment in the 98 midterms, didn't pick up many seats, actually lost seats. From the 94 revolution, Newt Gingrich ends up leaving Congress under a cloud of his own scandal. And so that's always the risk for Republicans. You push too much, you may alienate voters. But they still think that voters, especially independents, are angry about the IRS, and that's why they think it's something that's a viable issue for them moving forward.
And James Peterson, very few people love the IRS in this country.
Right.
This is
why you saw
time.
The president come out so quickly and so directly against him. Any opportunity that any politician has to throw a few darts at the IRS, they will take it, because although the IRS does one of the most important institutional jobs in our nation, it's easy to beat up on them because no one likes to pay taxes. But I think this is the reason why you've seen what Robert is talking about, is why you've seen Republican leadership moderate their talking points with respect to scandal and impeachment, because The president's approval rating went up a point or two last week, and it still remains to be seen if these three issues will sort of damage his public reputation. But at the end of the day, you don't want to overplay your hand, because the American people are sick of that kind of politics. We don't want to engage in that kind of political backbiting anymore. So that is what's not popular, even though these scandals may ultimately have some damage for the president.
Let me ask you about the attempt to pass gun background check for gun owners. And I'll put this to you, James Peterson, and then to you, Robert Costin. I do want to throw immigration and get some more callers in as well. But this was apparently supported by 90% of the American public, including a majority of people who are NRA members.
70+%. Yeah.
And yet this Congress, and including this president, could not get this passed. Why do you think that is? And then to you, Robert Costin.
It's, this is the way that our system is broken, right? There are politicians that are afraid of being outflanked, particularly on the right. And there are certain key issues where small niche demographics are very, very vocal and very, very sort of politic. Gun rights advocates are one of those. Obviously, anti-tax folk in the Tea Party are another group. And so, and this is why these scandals are really, really challenging for the president's agenda. Because in order for the kind of compromise we need from Republicans on immigration reform, on gun control, on the budget and on infrastructure spending, we have to have them in an environment where they're not fearful of being primaried in the 2014 election or in the run-up to the 2014 elections. And so these three scandals, I think, are good in the sense that it gives some of the Republican leadership an opportunity to make sure or to demonstrate publicly that they're in solidarity with those who are might possibly outflank them on the right. And that might create a space where we can have a little bit more compromise. But we've got to have compromise on those three things, and that might not be politically advantageous for some of those folk who are up for election.
And Robert Costin, the new word is primaried. It has become a verb. What are your thoughts?
I think the gun issue is a fascinating one, because I think there was room for that to pass in the Senate. You had a moderate Democrat like Joe Manchin, a conservative Republican who's now moving more to the center, and Pat Toomey trying to make that happen. But really, it's the larger gun culture in the red states that really stopped that from happening, because you had red state Republicans and red state Democrats vote against the background check bill. And I think that's what's really hurting the background check legislation, because, of course, in the Toomey Manchin bill, there was no national gun registry, but because of the NRA's lobbying, because of concerns that
in fact, they had the antithesis of a gun registry in there.
They actually made it illegal.
Yes.
But it's tough in a country where the NRA is such a large presence. It's tough where red state Democrats themselves are not willing to really take a bold risk ahead of the 2014 elections, which are going to be difficult. They can't lose gun owners if gun owners are wary of such legislation. But I think because someone like Pat Toomey was involved from Pennsylvania, this is not dead as an issue. It could come back. And real quick on immigration.
Sure, go ahead.
It's very easy to say that Washington now is consumed by scandal, because, well, it is. But immigration remains the driving legislative issue of this year. And Marco Rubio, senator from Florida, Hispanic background, Tea Party senator from 2010, there's always been buzz that he's looking for an exit ramp, that he doesn't really want to see this happen. But just look at the facts. Marco Rubio is still pushing this bill to talk radio. He's still pushing this bill ahead. The House leadership and the Senate leadership seem quite open to immigration reform. And I think a real turning point came last week. It went unnoticed in many ways because of the scandals. But Paul Ryan, the former VP for the Republicans last year, signed on to the House immigration plan, which very much echoes the Senate Gang of Eight plan. And if you have someone like Paul Ryan, who's a favorite of conservatives in the House, and someone like Marco Rubio pushing for immigration reform, let me tell you, that has a chance within the Republican Party.
That's great to hear you say that, Robert. It is great to hear you say that.
Let me get, looks like Ron from Bethlehem to join us on Radio Times. Ron, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Peterson, do you think it was a mistake of the Obama administration not to investigate the Bush administration in connection with the Iraq War?
I knew Thanks, that Ron. Question was going to come.
Yeah, go ahead.
Was it a mistake? Well, let me just be clear here. I would have loved to have seen members of the Bush administration prosecuted or at least made to answer for the miscarriage of justice around the use of information in the whole weapons of mass destruction scandal. But let me be clear here. I'm a pacifist, and so I'm anti-war pretty much, period. I'm anti-American imperialism pretty much, period. And so I don't know if it was if it was a mistake in a large, broader political sense, because I think from the Obama administration's perspective, that could have been looked at as being reactionary or as being parochial in terms of politics. But from my own personal viewpoint, I can tell you that, yes, I would love to see potential war criminals have to answer for their crimes. And I think anytime you have leaders in an administration deliberately misleading the American people into unnecessary wars, that that's a scandal of epic proportions.
Ron, thanks for the call. Robert, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, Dr. Peterson, I think, is raising some different points there. But the caller is asking why didn't he, the president, investigate Bush? I think because when the president came in January 2009, he had a very limited space of political capital. The Democrats controlled both the House and the Senate. And I know from my conversation with Democrats on Capitol Hill that Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi definitely went to the president. They considered going after some of the Bush administration. But because they had such limited time and capital, they decided not to do that and instead pass health care, pursue climate change. And I think when you look back at history, I think that was probably the smarter move. Instead of looking back and getting immersed in the Bush wars, the president tried to pass some of his signature legislation, and he ended up doing just that.
Let me get Ron, thanks for the call. Let me get John from Woodbury, New Jersey, to join us. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, how you doing?
Good.
Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome.
Listen, I'm listening to the conversation on a couple of things. On this immigration issue and why can't we get it passed through Congress. You know, we've allowed the Congress to destroy the electoral process by gerrymandering. These districts that we congressmen get elected from now are so synthesized and so finite because they gerrymandered the process, and so they can get elected no matter what they do. We don't have homogenized elected officials anymore. We have very specific officials who are extremely right or extremely left because they go back home in their district, and no matter what they voted for, no matter what they voted against, they get elected. And until the public gets onto this and demands that we set these districts up a better way and a fair way across the country, we're going to have that kind of problem, and we're not going to get anything passed.
Well,
it's going to get more, not less.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Robert Costa, is there some truth to that?
Oh, very much so. There's not much reason for many of these Democrats or Republicans to make movement towards the center when you know you have a safe seat. If there was more seats in Congress like those seats in the Philadelphia suburbs that seem to swing every different cycle, you'd have a more volatile Congress, a Congress that would be willing to take political risk to win those centrist voters. But if all you really care about is that primary, you brought that up, Marty, primary is the big concern, not general elections.
Right.
If all you care about is a primary, you're going to stay to your ideological base and not really move from that because you want to stay safe. It's a shame, but that's really, I think the caller is onto something here, and most people don't really seem to recognize that.
Go ahead, James. You want to add to that?
I think we're in complete agreement. The caller, Robert, and myself in complete agreement. I don't know exactly what the solution is to sort of roll back the kind of gerrymandering that's been occurring over the last two decades or so. But I think there's got to be an opportunity for us to have a conversation to make our government more representative. I don't think our Congress is representative of the United States, of the people that live and breathe in this country. So I don't know what the sort of political solution is to that, but we have to at least begin to talk about the fact that there's a disconnect between not just the House, but also the Senate and the actual constituents, the real people on the ground who live here in this country.
And all this happens at the state level. It's the legislatures that get to decide how to redraw these districts.
Indeed.
We're getting into
and
the...
And they do so politically. Democrats redraw them to the advantage of Democratic districts. Republicans redraw them to the advantage of Republican districts.
Robert, let me toss something to you. The House voted last week for, I've lost count, umpteenth time to repeal...
38th.
Is it 38? Okay. 37th, 38th time to repeal the Affordable Care Act. We're also learning, we learned from a Kaiser survey last week that something like 42% of Americans don't even know that the Affordable Care Act is the law. Do you think that's the intention of the House, which is to sort of raise questions among the American public about Obamacare, as it's now called?
Oh, yes. The Republicans tried to run on Obamacare in 2010, did pretty well, won the House. Tried to run on it in 2012, but it got mixed up in the larger Romney message. It fizzled as an issue. And they really think, once again in 2014, they're going to try to run on Obamacare. And a lot of Republican political strategists told me privately, raised their eyebrows, what the heck are Republicans doing, trying to repeal again, do a whole nother cycle running on Obamacare? But it really seems to be actually picking up some speed, at least within Republican circles, because there's going to be an attempt this summer and next year to tie the IRS scandal to Obamacare, because, of course, Obamacare, the Affordable Health Care Act, has a lot of the IRS has a major role in implementing the law, in managing the law. And if Republicans can try to almost tear down the IRS, they think they can tear down Obamacare in effect as well.
Well, and quoting Michelle Bachmann here, said something last week as a question, which is always an interesting way to raise something. Will the IRS use power to delay or deny health care for conservative Americans, James? And she's just, I'm only just asking.
Yeah. Well, that's not exactly the role the IRS would play in the sort of rollout of the Affordable Care Act. But it's a good political question because Robert is right. You were already seeing some Republican leaders attempt to make this link between the implementation of affordable health care and the IRS's role in that and the sort of abnegation of their responsibilities around the Tea Party targeting scandal that we've been talking about here this morning. I would want to slow down, back up a little bit. We had great information coming out of Oregon last week where they've implemented the state exchange, and we saw some prices come down by some providers. And I think the Obama administration still has to get the message clear on what the ACA is. I mean, because if you can make these exchanges work, costs will come down. It's a free market model. It has had Republican support in the past. So at the end of the day, I think we still have to clarify that message. And I would bet dollars to donuts that at least the Obama administration will be more than willing for the 2014 Republicans to try to wage their campaigns based on the implementation of Obamacare.
We only have a minute left. And actually, James, I want to toss this to you. Sorry, Robert, but the president gave a speech yesterday, a graduation speech at Morehouse College.
Indeed.
And about 45 seconds or less. So what was the president saying?
The president spoke at Morehouse College, historically black college. He spoke very personally about his own experiences, his own sense of what he's achieved. He talked a lot about the history of that great institution and folks like Dr. King and other people that came through that institution. But it's interesting because it presents this unique moment for me where the president can do something like that, which I think is really, really important, and it can be read in completely different ways. So you have some black folks saying, why is he talking about black people making excuses? You know, you have other folk on the left saying, hey, this is great. It's personal, right? And so I'm working through this, Marty. I'm going to try to write about this and sort through my thoughts and feelings about the president's address. But it is absolutely one of the most unique speeches that the president has given this year.
And that's James Peterson, Director of Africana Studies at Lehigh University. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. Robert Costa, next time you're in Philly, we'll have to have you in the studio.
Looking forward to it.
And he's Washington editor for National Review. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour. Stay with us, though. We'll be right back.